Hello. I want to welcome everyone this morning to our opening session, and I especially want to welcome our online audience. So this morning, we're going to be hearing about course rights in cyberspace, ownership issues in online education. And we have Pamela Levine and Martha Russell, who are both from MediaX at Stanford University. And I just want to remind everyone that when we get to the Q&A session at the end, that because of our online audience, we want to make sure they can hear, so please use one of the microphones. And if the speakers could remember to repeat the questions, that would be great. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Pamela.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. As you heard, I'm Pamela Levine. I'm from Stanford's Graduate School of Education, and this research was a collaboration with Martha Russell and MediaX. So I'm hoping that after the presentation, we can discuss some of the issues raised and any questions particularly related to the work of MediaX and their research, investigating some answers to these questions that Martha can help weigh in on some of those. So let's get started. Higher education is in the midst of change, and much of that is being driven by these advances in communications technology that are changing who we teach, how we teach, who's involved in the instructional process, and what their respective roles are. There's a lot of benefits to this new surge in online education. The technologies and the flexibility that they enable are allowing us to reach wider audiences of students than we have before, including those in situations that have prevented them from accessing education previously. Even for students who do have access to higher education or who might have already earned degrees, these online MOOCs are connecting people from different parts of the world in educational learning environments to work on problems and have discussions that where they may have never, they would not have had the chance to meet before. So I just finished offering a 10-week MOOC on the VentureLab platform, and I'll talk more about that experience. But I wanted to, in this MOOC, we had students in all different parts of the world working together on team projects. So I had students who had just finished a high school degree, and they were on a gap year trying to figure out what they wanted to do next, working on team projects with Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. We had a team of students from Palestine and Jordan and the U.S. developing educational technology solutions for learners in their communities. The online course brought them together to have these discussions and submit work together. And another benefit of online education is that with these new students and this new market, new curricula are being developed. But the implications of this expansion of online learning reach beyond teaching and learning. As existing university courses are being translated into online format, as new courses are being developed, as new materials are being produced, and more people are getting involved in this process, questions of who owns all this stuff are emerging. Answers to this question have the potential to influence business models of higher education, and optimal solutions haven't yet been found. So when we're talking about ownership, we're talking about copyright. So I'm going to go over some of the basics of that. To be copyrighted, a work has to be original, and it has to be fixed in a tangible medium. So a live lecture in front of an audience can't be copyrighted, but one that's video recorded, fixed in a tangible medium, can be. usually the person who creates the work and fixes it in a tangible medium is the copyright owner. But there are some exceptions. Under the 1976 Copyright Act, works for hire exceptions apply to employees within an institution. So what those works for hire exceptions say are that work completed within the scope and duties of employment can be interpreted as owned by the employer. For faculty, that would be the university. Now, many universities haven't adopted this business model, and little legal attention has historically been paid to works for hire rights to faculty-created materials for face-to-face teaching. Interpretations of this works for hire exception vary across universities, and even within a university can vary by employment agreements. So a tenured faculty might have a different agreement about their work completed in the university than a lecturer or a research staff or a contracted employee. Now, in the K-12 space, just last week this issue came up by a new policy proposed by Prince George's County Board of Education in Maryland. What this new policy proposed is that the board and the district were claiming ownership over teacher and student created materials. Now, neighboring Montgomery County and DC, where I was a teacher, have similar stipulations in their employment agreements that say that teachers or employees of the district creating educational materials using school supplies for their educational materials, that those can be considered to be property of the district. Where Prince George's County's policy differs is in its approach to work that's created off hours. Under the proposed policy, work created for the school are properties of the Board of Education, even if created on the employee's time and with the use of their own materials. Deanna Jump might have something to say about that. So people are criticizing this new policy as sufficiently extreme and calling it a revenue grab off of teacherpreneurs who are putting their lesson plans and even developing educational technologies for sale online on sites like Teachers Pay Teachers. Under the policy, this would potentially be the property of the school district. Now, as I said, traditions of sharing and academic freedom in universities have typically overshadowed these legal strictures associated with copyright and works for hire. So most universities aren't claiming ownership of these materials used for in-person teaching. But with the advent of online education, as more faculty are creating these courses and new types of materials are being created, as more university resources are being invested in these efforts and new revenue streams and business models are emerging, issues of copyright, ownership, and work for hire are being reexamined. So, whereas institutions have not typically exercised their ownership rights in face-to-face teaching, like I was saying, there's cases like Cambridge University Press versus Patton, where publishers sued four individuals at Georgia State University for putting copyrighted digital materials, distributing those through the university's online networks. Now, these materials were being used for face-to-face teaching, but distributed online. And this is a frequent practice in universities using tools like coursework and Blackboard. And so it's something that universities and faculty are having to navigate. And this in particular is one of the areas of work that MediaX and Martha Russell is focusing on to develop technology solutions for publish on demand. And so if there are questions about those particular efforts, she'll be a good person to ask at the end of the session. So I bring this up even though these materials were used for face-to-face teaching within the university. I bring it up to show, to say that the case has exposed some of the vulnerabilities that institutions of education are facing in terms of copyright infringement, and to say that universities and faculty and publishers are looking to this case to resolve these questions. Now, the Georgia State case shows how copyright has been difficult to apply in traditional classrooms. But when an instructor goes from this to this, they're navigating even more uncharted waters. So the laws are already difficult to apply in conventional education settings. But a challenge to faculty creating courses online is that there's an absence of legal standards and institutional policies for multimedia materials. When a faculty is creating courses for online distribution, there's new types of work that they're, and different conventions that they're employing as part of their course, such as video, animations, and images. And that differs significantly from what they've been using in face-to-face teaching. So I want to show you some examples. These video clips I'm about to show are from four MOOCs on four different platforms. And I want you to watch closely for the video effects and animations used here so that you can see the just how the materials are differing from your typical face-to-face classroom.
Hi, welcome to our course here, of course. This is the first time we've ever taught an online course. We're very excited about it. Oh! I'm Walter Sennett Armstrong from Duke University. My co-teacher is Ron Nettle from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Say hi, Ron.
Hi.
Thanks.
The surprising and important finding was only revealed because the scientists connected seemingly unrelated observations and patterns. Remember, connecting unexpected people, places, and objects provides a huge boost to your imagination. You can practice this by interacting with those outside your normal circles, building on existing ideas, and finding inspiration in unlikely places.
Let's take a look at the diagram in detail. I listed technology, content, pedagogy, and value. Why do I think these are most important elements to consider in designing an educational technology solution?
The Lean Launchpad class encapsulates everything we now know about how to build a successful startup. For the last 50 years, we kind of got it wrong.
So these educational materials include media and practices that don't fall under, that fall under copyright law that doesn't include educational provisions. And it's not known whether copyright law will hold up for these types of online educational works. Tina Seelig is one of the video clips that I showed, and she has a great course on Venture Lab called Crash Course in Creativity. And she has said that she has an entire team just devoted to creating animations for her online courses. So another challenge is that this is a different type of media, it's animations, that's being created, but also that these products for MOOCs nearly always require collaborations, and in many cases, entire teams of graphic designers, web designers, video production. So the fact that of these collaborations complicates the assignment of ownership of these materials. And I know this firsthand. As I said, I just finished offering a 10-week MOOC called Designing a New Learning Environment with Dr. Paul Kim from Stanford's Graduate School of Education on the Venture Lab platform. And this was actually kind of a rare scenario for MOOCs that we were putting it together almost entirely as a team of two. So besides just being a prolific poster in the discussion forums, I was also responsible for everything from curriculum design, creating the syllabus, creating assignments, assessments, rubrics, course policies, grading schemes, video storyboarding, video production, course promotion, and implementation. In fact, Paul has joked on many occasions that this was my MOOC and not his. So pulling it off required a lot of investment from both of us. Now, So what? So there can be a lot of cooks in the kitchen. What does that matter? Well, let's go back to that slide about the rights of a copyright holder. Now, under copyright law, jointly created work, which is, as I said, a frequent practice in creating these MOOCs, entitles both authors to all rights to reproduce, sell, give away, adapt the work product without, even without the consent of the other co-authors. So while university staff and researchers are collaborating with faculty on producing these MOOCs, universities are also investing big resources. They're building teams of instructional designers and video producers, and they're calling on their staff to help create and implement these courses. They're also rushing to partner with MOOC providers like Coursera, VentureLab, edX, and Udacity. And university policies haven't addressed where ownership within these collaborations lie. So in Coursera's agreement with University of Michigan, Coursera treats the instructor and the university as owner of independently created content. But it reserves the right to make course enhancements to course materials, and that can include translations, adaptations, captioning, encoding, transcripts, and video annotations. Under the law, it's not clear whether course enhancements or adaptations would entitle Coursera to the rights of a joint author. The terms and conditions of commercial MOOC companies require close scrutiny, and not all MOOCs should be assumed to be open. Now, Stanford's Vice Provost for Online Learning, John Mitchell, has been firm in expressing support for the faculty and says that MOOC materials created by Stanford faculty belong to Stanford and not the MOOC providers. He says, with our terms of service, we're not transferring ownership to MOOC platforms, we're just letting them show the material on their website. However, Stanford faculty member and VentureLab developer Amin Saberi argues that standards need to be developed to a higher degree. And he says we need more developmental standards, policies in terms of control and ownership, and responsible online practice within the university. Copyright is implicated by many of these new possibilities brought about by the changing landscape, and the evolution of university policies is lagging behind the technological advances. Again, so what? Well, online education is a potentially lucrative venture, and so that's changed many universities' once casual attitude about content ownership. The capacity of MOOCs to be delivered to wide audiences has the potential to change financial dynamics of institutions. And the increasing number of for-profit MOOC providers can be seen as evidence of this shift in thinking. Here's another example of this shift. Last October, Antioch University entered into a contract with Coursera to license courses from Duke and UPenn as a part of their bachelor's degree program. This effort would lower the full cost of the degree for the Antioch students. This is one of the first examples of a third-party institution buying permission to incorporate a MOOC into its curriculum, and it's also one of the first steps for Coursera towards developing a content licensing business model. As part of this agreement, Antioch University will pay an undisclosed amount to Coursera to use the courses, and Coursera will share that revenue with the universities. The universities may or may not share that revenue with the faculty who created the course. At Duke, Lynn O'Brien, the director of the Center for Innovative Teaching, has said that when Coursera makes money, we'll make money. And when we make money, the faculty will make money. The faculty member will make money. So this model creates incentives for the universities as well as the faculty member. They haven't released the details of this agreement in terms of the percentage breakdowns of this revenue stream in the agreement, but the increased actual and potential value of these digital education products is driving a re-examination of university agreements around copyright and works for hire. Remember that online education MOOCs are being produced based on the intellectual property of faculty. Sometimes they're being created based on existing courses that a faculty has been offering for a long time, or a new course that's created specifically for online purposes. But often supplementary human and financial resources are often used in creating this content. So who owns it? Well, several national organizations have expressed recommendations on the answer to that question. The American Association of University Professors says that universities should uphold the traditional practice of allowing faculty to maintain ownership of this work, regardless of the physical medium in which it appears. But they also acknowledge that there's some cases where universities are investing significant resources, and they've suggested that perhaps the faculty can maintain the copyright but reimburse for those efforts. The Association of American Universities says that the university should own the intellectual property that is created by faculty and research staff. The Association of Research Libraries hasn't provided a recommendation in terms of ownership, but has stated that the copyright status of materials used in MOOCs is a key legal issue raised by these online courses. The AAUP, NEA, and several other organizations have agreed that there's a need for revisiting copyright doctrine and the formulation of copyright policy at university and national levels. Meanwhile, at the university level, schools are approaching this issue differently. Princeton is one of the schools engaged in this debate, and they put forth a whole new class of policy for specifically for materials used in online courses in response to a faculty backlash to their initial suggestion that online courses fall under patent policy that allows the universities to claim ownership. The University of Chicago's policy asserts that the university owns the faculty-created materials, whereas Stanford, as we heard before from John Mitchell, assigns complete ownership to the faculty. University of Minnesota's academic affairs and provost actually outlines multiple scenarios on their website that assign ownership depending on whether the faculty or administration initiated the effort, so who initiated the creation of this course, whether materials used in an online course were pre-existing, what level of university resources were invested, and how uniformly or not those resources were invested across a department. So it's difficult to predict how these questions of ownership will be handled, but it's sure that the MOOC process will move quickly as the technologies are more effective and scalable than ever before. To avoid legal entanglements, institutions need to be proactive and comprehensive in developing policies that both coordinate expectations, serve the interests of education, and protect those involved in the development and design of online courses. Faculty members and institutions interested in retaining their rights to control and reuse their course content created for online teaching should pay close attention to both their university policies as well as the license agreements they may sign with the MOOC providers. So thank you, everyone, for coming today, and I'd like to open it up to questions or people in the room's own experience with these policies and online courses and questions about the work of MediaX. Thank you again.
Yeah. Can you talk a little
Sure. I'm going to repeat the question for online. The question is about challenges and issues arising from reusing existing work that perhaps a faculty member has already published. And then there's also two parts to this question. There, in my mind, there's existing work that the faculty themselves offering the MOOC has published, and then there's existing work that they might have used as supplementary material in their course that they didn't publish. So in terms of faculty-created, like let's say a faculty produces publishes a textbook and they want to use some of that in their online course. Well, and the issues that arise with that are when they're translating it now into online format and fixing it in a new medium and perhaps calling on students or staff to help them do that, their once individual work is now becoming a collaboration. In my experience with people who are creating these MOOCs right now, usually the faculty don't have, or any one person doesn't have all the skills to, you know, produce the video and put it into online format. So if a student is creating an animation based on your work, then does it become a jointly created work that both have the rights to? Or if the faculty does do all the work, but then they put it on a MOOC platform, and that's hosted, that might have the course enhancements, does that MOOC platform then have the rights to distribute, adapt, revise, sell it and make a profit, give it away for free, and those kind of questions? So in that situation, I would recommend that the person offering the course be clear with themselves about what their intention is with the course and also with those materials following the course. For our online course with Dr. Paul Kim, we wanted to know what it was like to offer a MOOC and what was involved in that process. So one of the first questions I asked Paul was, what's your thoughts on this in terms of copyright and intellectual property? And he was very clear about, you know, I don't care, I'll give it away for free. I always want it to be free. I don't want to sell it. I want to enrich people's educational experiences and know what a MOOC is like. But that's not the same view that other faculty members have, particularly if they're including work that they've already been selling in the form of a textbook. Now, the second type of pre-existing materials might be a textbook or an article from another author that you've used in your courses already. And that is another big issue for MOOCs. That, in terms of, in face-to-face teaching, obviously, faculty can use those materials and are protected under fair use and those types of guidelines. And they can incorporate those into their teaching or without, you know, without complications, or students can purchase their rights to particular articles and things like that. But when you're putting it online in a MOOC, you are giving it away for free beyond just the Stanford audience or the university. So I've seen different MOOCs handling this differently. What we did was we just didn't use any of those articles because it was complicated. But obviously that compromises what you can do. We tried to do some video reviews of different articles and things like that in order to not provide the specific article, but to give the information. Other MOOCs at Stanford have used MediaX, their SIPX solution, which maybe Martha can talk more about, which provided links to educational materials that students from around the world could pay a small fee to use, and perhaps the instructor treated those materials as optional in order to keep the course as free. But yeah, it gets sticky when you're trying to reach students in Africa and places where the cost of those materials might be prohibitive. So those are the ways that I've seen people handling it, but certainly the rules of fair use don't apply in the same ways in online education. Even using materials and giving attributions or even images is, again, uncharted water. And for us, we didn't do it because we didn't want to get into that. But I've seen some MOOCs use images or things like that and give attributions. But it's a lot trickier than in the face-to-face instruction. So Martha, I didn't know if you want to talk about the way SIPEX can help faculty creating MOOCs provide these articles that they've been using and would like to enrich their courses. I know that SIPEX was used in Professor Dan McFarland's MOOC on organizational behavior and analysis offered on the Coursera platform. This MOOC was both a Stanford 4-credit course for Stanford students, as well as an open MOOC for the entire world. So they did kind of a flipped classroom model, and this is a required course that has a lot of reading, so they couldn't just skip that part. So.
Thank you. I'll say a little bit about SIPEX, but I will direct you to the website. It's a result of research that was conducted at Stanford through the sponsorship of MediaX and our corporate partners, and after proving itself successful at Stanford, it has been spun out, and SIPEX.com, Stanford Intellectual Property Exchange. It actually began as a research initiative in about 2005 when people began to notice that it looked like all those folks using the internet wanted to contribute. And as we do with MediaX, we take broad questions and parse them out to the disciplines and to the labs at Stanford and say, how would you go about studying this? How would you frame a question? And one of the responses to that came back saying, well, we think there could be some legal issues if the audience wants to contribute content to the internet. And beginning by studying that, and that was in 2005, 2006, and each year iterating the questions as they would change, led to a pilot program in which the copyright licenses were studied very thoroughly to identify patterns in them, the code that, how that could be translated to code, and university policies for blanket licenses and so on and so forth were studied. Out of that was created the Stanford Intellectual Property Exchange, which now is available to universities. Stanford is using it fairly broadly. The MOOCs are using it, a number of them, and it's now being tested in a number of other universities. But more broadly, the issues of publish on demand are of considerable interest as a frontier area of research, because we know that content becomes increasingly fragmented, and one person might, as Pamela's saying, in a classroom, use an image or a chart from somebody's study, and it would be fine to do that under fair use. Putting a chart or an image or an animation that someone else has created into a video that is part of a MOOC, widely disseminated, distributed, really calls for some new technology, one to track it and find out who's using it, and audience metrics of engagement and so on and so forth, but also the legal issues. So SIPX.com.
Any other questions? Yes.
Not a question, but I guess I'll make a statement.
Can you use the microphone for the online audience? Thank you so much.
Not a question as much as a statement to react to. The observation from our university and all the faculty and staff working together as a team is a new document on copyright that starts out with, if you don't sit down with your department chair and carve out an independent document that describes your relationship to the university as a faculty member, the university's relationship to you, then you've made a big mistake to start with. Because everything that you have said says that with the different media that's available and the changing of that media, we lack legal precedent, not standards, but legal precedent to define in general what your responsibilities and rights are. And so by carving out an individual agreement as a matter of just that's the way we do business, you are establishing for yourself. The other thing that all the discussion hasn't considered is there's a whole other layer to this, and that is a faculty member with 30 years of tenure and 30 years of credentialing known in the field around the world can cut a different deal than a brand new faculty member.
Right.
And so as a consequence of that, review it often at major academic milestones that reestablishes the relationship between you, the university, the public, and so on.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I agree. That would be my number one recommendation for faculty and for institutions entering into this new venture. And in many cases, what we're seeing, though, is not that, is whatever called the Silicon Valley model, where enthusiasm and excitement is built first and business models and policies are developed later. But for a faculty member who's putting their work online, the first thing that they should do is look at their existing agreement and make those steps to create documentation as necessary and review them with the appropriate offices within the university to have those so that they've thought through and so that they're official. And then also look at the agreements with the MOOC providers as well, because that will play a role in how the MOOCs end up using that material. We also need to revisit copyright law at a national level. There, in the past, there's been some efforts to adapt and update these laws for the digital age in education, but they haven't gone so far as what we're seeing now with the MOOCs. So that would be, you know, a bigger step, but I would say start, you know, with your own self and what those agreements are saying and what your personal motivations are and how this course could be used, what level of control you want over it. Yes.
So I think what the previous speaker raises is that, like everything else in the electronic revolution, there's actually an anarchy out there, and there's going to be a huge transfer of wealth from one place to another, creation of wealth and transfer of wealth. And where our institutions go is a critical part of that. And I think different sorts of institutions are going to benefit and suffer differentially. So at Stanford, and I'm also from Stanford, there's a certain smugness that we're going to ride this wave and we're going to do well. But the reality is you have a huge swath of people, some of whom are not being educated and some of whom at a higher education level now, who are going to take advantage of this, and some of whom are being educated. And there's a lot of funds involved in that. And I think the copyright question goes right to the issue of how are some of the longstanding institutions that won't be able to ride the wave the way Stanford can, what is their future funding model going to be? I don't think
right.
There's an answer. But the curiosity of each individual creating their own copyright agreement is that the answers are probably going to bubble up from the bottom rather than down from the top.
Right. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I think that's a really good comment, and I'd like to just build on that by saying it's not just the educational institutions who are looking at new business models. And this afternoon, I'll present some information about the innovation ecosystem of startups, of growth companies, and the shifts in enterprises that have been established as serving the educational industry. and the way that all of these are shifting in response to the new business opportunities as well as the educational opportunities.
Yes, thank you.
You touched on this briefly, but what about the ownership of the students' contribution to the MOOC? So, for example, somebody posts a really interesting assignment and the professor decides, okay, I'm going to use that as an example the next time I teach and I'm going to discuss the students' work. Are the students being asked to accept a shrink wrap license when they start that gives up the rights to their work? How's that being handled?
Yeah, that was a big issue that came up in our Venture Lab course, and I would imagine comes up in quite a few of the Venture Lab courses in particular, because right now the MOOC platform is surrounding classes about entrepreneurship and ventures and creating innovation in teams. And what I've seen on Venture Lab and on Coursera is an agreement, as you said, that the students have to agree to as part of their participation and entry into the MOOC, that their work created in the course is the property of the platform. That's certainly
enforceability.
Well, on the student side, or
whether the student really can't waive those rights.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, I mean, I could only, hypothesize about how that would actually play out in a court case, but right now that's a consideration for students. And that's another thing that was actually interesting about that Prince George's County policy, is that in their proposed policy, they're proposing to own the work of students within the district as well, which they've been heavily criticized for and we haven't seen in other school districts. Now, another related issue in terms of student work is also student data, and that's a big motivation for a lot of faculty and institutions creating MOOCs, is the research opportunities and analytics. And who owns those is another question that, if that's a particular motivation, you would want to be clear about. And I'm seeing that the time is up. So thank you everyone so much for coming and for participating in the discussion afterwards, and have a great rest of the conference.